Hello, folks. I greatly appreciate you all tuning in to the Federalist Files. We have Federalist number 84 today. It's titled Certain General and Miscellaneous Objections to the Constitution Considered and Answered, written by Alexander Hamilton, July 16th, 1788. Topics include inherent rights in the Constitution, rights cannot be usurped, Constitution established by the people, for the people, importance of a free press, and need for taxation to pay off debts. So, in this paper, Hamilton pretty much thinks up of all of the arguments that he is yet to confront, and he takes them all, whether they're the miscellaneous objections, and he answers them in this paper. And then I think the next one, he wraps it all up, and then, I mean, we have this one, and then we have 85, and then we're all done here. But in this paper, Hamilton answers to the objections of the proposed Constitution that have yet to be discussed. One of the most notable objections is that the Constitution contains no Bill of Rights. So this was an objection which the Anti-Federalists actually didn't like the idea of having a Bill of Rights. They also didn't like the idea of having this overbearing government. So in this paper, Hamilton answers to objections of the proposed Constitution that have yet to be discussed. One of the most notable of these objections is that the Constitution contains no Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights was ratified, was passed along in 1789, I believe. So 17, or rather, I'm trying to think if it's 17, yeah, 1787, the Constitution is ratified. And then after that, a couple years later, I want to say 1789 maybe, or maybe it's a couple years after that. But the Bill of Rights, whatever. So there's no Bill of Rights contained in this Constitution. That's an objection of some dissenters. The Anti-Federalists actually didn't like the idea of having a Bill of Rights, because then that means that that somehow would be confounded by people in this country in the future, by the posterity, and they would think that that gives the government some sort of right to regulate the people's Bill of Rights. So there's people that are on both sides of this. Now, Hamilton actually had a very surprising view of it. He was much more siding with the Anti-Federalists. He said, there are certain rights that are already inalienable written into the Constitution. But the absence of power, because this is supposed to be a positive document, everything that's kind of stated here, it's supposed to be the positives of the powers that the federal government has. Now, if the federal government doesn't give a jurisdiction or does not give an outright prohibition of something in the Constitution, then that means it's either the state's right to regulate it, or it's up to the people to decide. Meaning, let's say, for example, there's no regulations of firearms in the Constitution, right? Let's say the Bill of Rights was never written. That means the government doesn't really have the power to take away the arms and the guns from the people. Because there is no power that the government can do so. The government can write legislation, can make laws, but they can't disarm the people. It's just not written under their jurisdictional power in the Constitution. It does not empower the federal government to do so. That's the argument. Now, if you write some sort of law into the Bill of Rights like they did, and they end it in shall not be infringed, very importantly, then that kind of people may confound that amendment, thinking it's somehow malleable and it can be changed, or made, or it's mutable, it can be formed and sculpted into what you want it to be, but that's just not the case. So, he states, and I quote, "The most considerable of the remaining objections is that the plan of the convention contains no Bill of Rights. To the first, I answer that the Constitution proposed by the convention contains, as well as the Constitution of the state, so the state of New York, a number of such provisions." So he's saying already written into the Constitution, there are provisions of rights that are inalienable. The government cannot take them from the people. They are granted by God, right? It's already written into the Constitution. So he contends that the provisions of the Constitution alone give citizens inherent rights. Hamilton incorporates some, such as ensuring habeas corpus, which is a right to trial, prohibiting ex post facto law, which is now making a law and then enforcing it retroactively after the fact, and prohibiting bills of attainder. Now, bills of attainder are legislative acts declaring one guilty of a crime, usually without a trial. Okay, so all those are written into the Constitution. Those are all considered rights for the people. It protects the people. It's restricting the government specifically. unequivocally. So he states all the inherent freedoms here, and he talks about the different articles, sections, and clauses. So he states, and I quote, "Independent of those which relate to the structure of the government, we find the following. Article 1, Section 3, Clause 7, and I'm quoting from the Constitution, judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and the disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States, but the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to the law." Now, Section 9 of the same article, Clause 2, states, and I quote, "The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended, unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it." Clause number 3, "No bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed." Clause 7, "No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of the Congress, except of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state," end quote. So this does protect the people. No titles of nobility is actually written. That's the Third Amendment to the Constitution, just to make it very unequivocal that there are no titles of nobility in the United States. So he actually continues to go on here. He states next, and I quote, "Article 3, Section 2, Clause 3 from the Constitution, the trial of all crimes, except in cases of impeachment, shall be by jury, and such trial shall be held in the state where the said crimes shall have been committed. But when not committed within any state, the trial shall be at such place or places as the Congress may by law have directed." Section 3 of the same article states, "Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them, or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act, or on confession in open court." Now, Clause 3 of the same section, "The Congress shall have power to declare the punishment of treason, but no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except during the life of the person attainted." End quote. So that's pretty much, you can't pass on the guilt through the bloodline. So if my father was convicted of treason, I can't also be convicted of treason just because I'm related to him. So Hamilton characterizes ex post facto law as, and I'm quoting, "the favorite and most formidable instrument of tyranny," end quote, which is correct here. Furthermore, Hamilton cites that there shall be no titles of nobility in trial of all crimes, will be with the exception of the cases of impeachment, shall be by jury, as I stated before. So it goes on to state, and I quote, "The establishment of the writ of habeas corpus, the prohibition of ex post facto laws, and the titles of nobility to which we have no corresponding provision in our Constitution are perhaps greater securities to liberty and republicanism than any it contains." So when he says, when he's talking no corresponding provision in our Constitution, he's talking about the Constitution of New York. So he's saying that this actually affords more rights to the individual in the federal Constitution. So he states, "are perhaps greater securities of liberty and republicanism than any it contains. The creation of crimes after the commission of the fact, or in other words, the subjecting of men to punishment for things which, when they were done, were breaches of no law, and the practice of arbitrary imprisonment, have been in all ages the favorite and most formidable instruments of tyranny," end quote. So yes, those are all some of the biggest rights that are afforded to the people, right? So another claim for the necessity of the bill of a Bill of Rights is that the legislature has provisional power to make alterations to the law. Hamilton contends, and I quote, "It is evident, therefore, that according to their primitive signification, they have no application to constitutions professedly founded upon the people of the people and executed by their immediate representatives and servants. Here in strictness, the people surrender nothing, and as they retain everything, they have no need of particular reservation," end quote. So what he's saying is, the federal government doesn't have the power themselves to alter the Constitution, which he is correct. You would have to go through the state. The state is so directly representative. The state legislative authority is so directly representative of the people that the federal government themselves cannot even give themselves more power even if they wanted to. They would have to, if they had to go through the constitutional amendment, they would have to go through the state authorities. So Hamilton argues that the power is in the hands of the people, not the legislature. He believed that by furnishing a Bill of Rights, it gives weight to the notion that it can be altered through legislation. He states from the preamble of the Constitution, and I'm quoting, "We, the people of the United States, to secure the blessing of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." End quote. So once again, he just reiterates that to say, this is of the people, for the people. We created this thing. We ordain it, as in we make it effective. We establish this Constitution for the United States of America, and it cannot be altered by some sort of bureaucrat or some sort of politician. I mean, in today's modern age, we have bureaucrats pretty much running the government, like the CDC right now with mask mandates. So furthermore, he uses... Furthermore, he states next, and I quote, "But a minute detail of particular rights is certainly far less applicable to a constitution like that under consideration, which is merely intended to regulate the general political interests of the nation, than to a constitution which has the regulation of every species of personal and private concerns. If, therefore, the loud clamors against the plan of the convention on this score are well-founded, no epithets of reprobation will be too strong for the constitution of this state." End quote. So he's talking about the specific, and then at the end he has to mention the New York Constitution is, once again, he's saying we're not going to go into deep specifics about the rights of the people because this is a positive constitutional document. It lists the powers of the federal authority. Anything that's not mentioned in here, it is not of their jurisdiction. So we don't even need to say that the people have these inherent God-given rights because that is just automatically assumed. That is the case, and there's no legislative authority that can stop that from happening. They would need to do a constitutional provision, which they can't do from the federal government. They would have to do it through the state legislative body. So if you were to list those rights out like we did, we ended up doing years later in the Bill of Rights, he's saying that people then can believe, which actually now does paint true in today's modern day, that there's an altering that can happen of the Constitution from the federal authorities. So furthermore, he uses the freedom of press as a very solid example and how there is no inherent, there is an inherent freedom of the press, free speech, and the government has no power regulating any of that. And there's nothing listed in the Constitution, therefore, any positive powers of the government, therefore, there is no need to say that there is a freedom of press or freedom of speech. States, and I quote, "I go further and affirm that bills of rights, in the sense and to the extent in which they are contended for, are not only unnecessary in the proposed Constitution, but would even be dangerous. They would contain various exceptions to power not granted, and on this very account would afford a colorable pretext to claim more than were granted. For why declare that things shall not be done which there is no power to do? Why, for instance, should it be said that the liberty of the press shall not be restrained when no power is given by which restrictions may be imposed?" End quote. So that's a very important. The very last sentence perfectly depicts and explains what I have been alluding to this entire time. "For instance, should it be said that the liberty of the press shall not be restrained when there's already no power that is given by which restrictions may be imposed?" There's no power written into the Constitution that gives the federal government the power to restrict freedom of speech or freedom of the press. Therefore, there's no reason to say that it shall not be restrained or that we shall have a free press. And then if you do that, if you put some sort of validation in there in the in a government document, then it's thought that it's somehow malleable, that it's not an inherent basic right, and that it can be somehow changed or restricted by the government. He outlines that the Constitution doesn't give the legislative power to infringe on press freedoms. Therefore, there is no reason for a freedom provision in relation to press. Furthermore, it would be inferred that if a right weren't contained in the Bill of Rights, then it wouldn't be treated as such, which is a very good point. So right now you have people making the distinction, the moral equivalency. They're saying, well, there's nothing in the Bill of Rights that says that you can't get vaccinated. But there's basic inherent human dignity that says you have control and you have sovereignty in yourself. And this is inherent. This doesn't have to be written into the Constitution. This is inherent freedom straight from judicial, from Judeo-Christian values, okay? And that's what this country's been founded on. So he adds, he states next, and I quote, "I will not contend that such a provision would confer a regulating power, but it is evident that it would furnish to men disposed to usurp a plausible pretense for claiming that power. They might urge with a semblance of reason that the Constitution ought not to be charged with the absurdity of providing against the abuse of an authority which was not given, and that the provision against restraining the liberty of the press afforded a clear implication that a power to prescribe proper regulations concerning it was intended to be vested in the national government." End quote. So thank you. You have people that are going to be willing, or they'll have inclinations to usurp their power, and they will use that opportunity in the having a Bill of Rights to say, well, we can regulate this. This is a governing document. That's the way they'll look at it, and they'll try to take advantage of that system and exploit it. Hamilton states that the Constitution itself is a Bill of Rights of the Union formulated by the people who played an instrumental role in the establishment of the government. So next he states, and I quote, "There remains but one other view on this matter to conclude the point. The truth is, after all the declamations we have heard that the Constitution is itself, in every rational sense and to every useful purpose, a Bill of Rights, the several Bill of Rights in Great Britain form its Constitution, and conversely, the Constitution of each state is its Bill of Rights. And the proposed Constitution, if adopted, will be the Bill of Rights of the Union." End quote. Yes. So there's no need for a Bill of Rights. They don't have it in Great Britain. They don't have it in the states. It's any, because the Constitution itself is a positive governing document, whatever's listed there, that's the power and the authority of the federal government. Otherwise, you can screw off. All those other powers are either given to the states or it's given to the people themselves. So next, he states, and I quote, "It certainly must be immaterial what mode is observed as to the order of declaring the rights of the citizens, if they are to be found in any part of the instrument which establishes the government. And hence it must be apparent that much of what has been said on this subject rests merely on verbal and nominal distinctions entirely foreign from the substance of the thing." End quote. So he's saying we shouldn't have the same document that creates our government and gives our government power. We shouldn't list the people's rights afterwards, because then we'll kind of infer that the federal government has the power to now restrict those rights because it's part of the governing document, those inherent basic freedoms. So Hamilton answers other contentions that the people will be unable to hold their representatives accountable because a deficiency of accessibility or accessible information of government activity. So there was obviously the contentions that the people are not going to be able to hold the authorities liable to what they do. And this is an anti-federalist argument that was in favor of no real federal government, federal head like this, and have it run by the state authorities and just have this Congress assembled like they had in the Articles of Confederation. And the reason why Hamilton says this is just an unfair analysis, he starts to talk about the freedom of press and as well as state representatives that will inform the local municipalities and the jurisdictions and the people, their constituency, what's going on in the federal head, because the state government wants more power in their hands and less power in the federal government's hands. So they will inform the people any usurpations by the federal authorities. So he states next, and I quote, "It is improper, you say, the objective to confer such large powers as are proposed upon the national government, because the seat of that government must of necessity be too remote from many of the states to admit of a proper knowledge on the part of the constituent of the conduct of the representative body. This argument, if it proves anything, proves that there ought to be no general government whatever." End quote. So yeah, what he's saying, once again, if you have somebody that lives in Georgia, and at this time the meetings were taking place in Philly, Georgia is so far away from Philly, they're saying those people are going to be so unattached to those people that live in Georgia. And he says that's just not the case, and he kind of goes on to explain the press. Hamilton expresses reverence for the press by outlining the importance of the press as the information hubs of all citizens to inform the people and aid them in their decisions, as well as bestow knowledge upon them in relation to current issues. So yeah, Hamilton later on actually created the New York Post. So he was a fan of the press himself. So he states, and I quote, "There is in most of the arguments which relate to distance a palpable illusion of the imagination. What are the sources of information by which the people in Montgomery County must regulate their judgment of the conduct of their representatives in the state legislature. Of personal observation, they can have no benefit. This is confined to the citizens on the spot. They must therefore depend on the information of intelligent men in whom they confide, and how must these men obtain their information? Evidently, from the complexion of public measures, from the public prints, as in the media, from correspondences with their representatives and with other people who reside at the place of their deliberations, this does not apply to Montgomery County only, but to all the counties at any considerable distance from the seat of government. End quote. So you have to also understand, you had a rudimentary federal government at this time. Even upon creation, there wasn't this huge, powerful military industrial complex. This wasn't going on. So if there was a usurpation by the federal government, state governments can legitimately take out the federal government if they wanted to at this time. This was a very unstable time. So this was also a time where the federal government wasn't going to try to overstep its boundaries. And everybody was talking because you just fought a revolution. People, you shed so much American blood for independence, and people aren't going to be willing to just give up their freedoms and give up their rights in this case, right? So they're going to talk to each other. You're going to talk to your neighbor. You're going to talk to your state representatives. You're going to talk to, you know, other state legislators, even local legislators for that matter. So Hamilton mentions the state representatives as another source of intelligence. He states, and I quote, "The executive and legislative bodies of each state will be so many sentinels over the persons employed in every department of the national administration, and as it will be in their power to adopt and pursue a regular and effectual system of intelligence, they can never be at a loss to know the behavior of those who represent their constituents in the national councils, and can readily communicate the same knowledge to the people, their disposition to apprise the community of whatever may prejudice its interests from another quarter, may be relied upon if it were only from the rivalship of power. And we may conclude with the fullest assurance that the people through that channel will be better informed of the conduct of their national representatives than they can be by any means they now possess of that of their state representatives," end quote. So yeah, there's going to be a battle, there's going to be conflict, a push and pull between the state representatives, or rather the state legislators, and the federal legislators for power, because the state legislators want to preserve as much power and authority in the state government and in the local jurisdictions, because they know on that local level is the best way to spend your money. You're going to be the most effectual, and you're going to represent the people as best as you can, right? You represent the constituency better than the federal heads do, the federal authorities do. So you yourself, you're going to let your people know that live, your constituents that live in these areas, of what the federal government is doing and the usurpations being attempted at this exact moment, right? So he's going to go on, he states next, and I quote, "It ought also to be remembered that the citizens who inhabit the country at and near the seat of government will, in all questions that affect the general liberty and prosperity, have the same interest with those who are at a distance, and that they will stand ready to sound the alarm when necessary and to point out the actors in any pernicious project. The public papers will be expeditious messengers of intelligence to the most remote inhabitants of the Union," end quote. So that's the really most important, is the very last sentence. They're talking about if you're federal, let's say you're in, you know, the 13th district of New Jersey, which I think that's my district. We have Bonnie Watson Coleman. The constituency votes for her. You know, this is all theoretical. This is how it's supposed to work. If there's any usurpations from the federal government on the state of New Jersey, she's supposed to come over to her constituency and say, "Hey, listen, the federal government's trying to do this or that to you guys. I'm just letting you know. I'm just speaking out." She doesn't do that, obviously. She loves usurpation by the government. She loves the police state. She loves the welfare state. Sorry, folks. Just a little burp. But she loves the welfare state. And that's it. Unfortunately, the system does, theoretically, it sounds good, but the system doesn't work this way because we have the government wants to take more power away from the citizenry. The people that we elect want to take more power away from us in the federal legislative body, and depending on what state you live in, from the state legislative body as well, especially in the state of New Jersey specifically. And like I said, the most important part, the public papers, is in the press, will be expeditious messengers of intelligence. And I think what we've kind of lost in today's day and age is an honest press. I'm not saying every single press site. I know Daily Caller, Just the News, New York Post is kind of wishy-washy. But in terms of telling the truth, those generally are pretty good truth tellers, or actually reporting the story. Because the left wing has nothing to do with whether or not they tell the truth. They embellish and they exaggerate stories, and they do, on some cases, like the New York Times did, they lie about Brian Sicknick, Officer Sicknick, on January 6th, saying that he was bludgeoned to death with a fire extinguisher, which turns out not to be true at all, right? So you have the press make stuff up in this country. But then at the same time, I think actually the biggest problem from our press is they don't report the important stories that they're supposed to report. And it has nothing to do with the bleeds it leads, because these stories are so important that they would actually make money. They would be incentivized to report these stories, but they're not going to, because they have an allegiance to the DNC and to the establishment. So next, Hamilton explains another contention of the centers, which call for the canceling of state debts and the construction of the new United States. Hamilton characterizes, and I quote, "This has been represented as a tacit relinquishment of those debts as a wicked contrivance to screen public defaulters," end quote. So Hamilton expresses that these arguments are derived from extreme ignorance or extreme dishonesty. He recognizes that the cost of citizens will increase, but not by a wide margin of what was being paid for before, but the juice is worth the squeeze. So he's saying pretty much, the dissenters are saying, because this establishment of this new government is going to cost us so much more money, there's going to be some heavy taxation. This turns out not to be true. Now we pay heavy taxation, but at that time we had a lot of repayments that we had to make because of the Revolutionary War. We were in debt, but the taxation was not overbearing or tyrannical in any nature. So he states, and I quote, "States neither lose any of their rights nor are discharged from any of their obligations by a change in the form of their civil government. The last objection of any consequence which I at present recollect turns upon the article of expense. If it were even true that the adoption of the proposed Constitution would occasion a considerable increase of expense, it would be an objection that ought to have no weight against the plan," end quote. So this is actually one of the biggest ones, is how expensive it's going to be. And he spends a good amount of time kind of debunking this myth. So he states, I think I lost my place here. So he's gonna go on, he's going to debunk this. He states, first he states, and I quote, "The great bulk of the citizens of America are with reason convinced that union is the basis of their political happiness." Hamilton, he outlines the organizational structure of the proposed government and factors that with the pace of progress of population and resources of the country, this will serve as adequate in the payments of those administrations. So this is what they're worried about. They're worried about paying off the administrations. So he states, and I quote, "The great bulk of the citizens of America are with reason convinced that union is the basis of their political happiness. Men of sense of all parties now, with few exceptions, agree that it cannot be preserved under the present system, nor without radical alterations, that new and extensive powers ought to be granted to the national head, and that these require a different organization of the federal government, a single body being an unsafe depositary of such ample authorities. In conceding all this, the question of expense must be given up, for it is impossible with any degree of safety to narrow the foundation upon which the system is to stand," end quote. So he's saying it's hard to figure out exactly how much we're willing to spend, but for terms of self-preservation, this system has to continue because the happiness of the people and the safety of the people rely on it. And then he kind of actually goes on to explain the expenses and how it won't be as expensive as people think comparatively to how expensive it is currently under the current established system. Hamilton, he adds, "Under the Articles of Confederation, the preservation isn't impossible. Isn't possible. Any man of sense would admit that the expense is worth the preservation of the United States." So he states, and I quote, "The two branches of the legislature are, in the first instance, to consist of only 65 persons, which is the same number of which Congress under the existing Confederation may be composed. It is true that this number is intended to be increased, but this is to keep pace with the progress of the population and resources of the country. It is evident that a less number would, even in the first instance, have been unsafe, and that a continuance of the present number would, in more advanced stage of population, be a very inadequate representation of the people," end quote. So yeah, as the population continues to progress, you will have more representatives in the House, and it will be easier to pay off these debts. If you wanted to say, let's go to almost a skeletal structure of our government as proposed in the Constitution, if you want to just talk about paying our federal representatives, paying our senators, paying our presidents, it would be very cheap. It would be very inexpensive. If I had to sit here and guess for you folks, I'd say maybe around $1 billion. Like, that's actually how cheap it would be if we just paid those people specifically. Now, when it comes to judges, then that actually holds even more and more money. But right now, we're running about a $4 trillion budget every single year. So it's not even close to if we ran, you know, a bare bones administration of government as proposed in the Constitution. Now, he goes on next to state, and I quote, Where then are we to seek for those additional articles of expense which are to swell the account to the enormous size that has been represented to us? The chief item which occurs to me respects the support of the judges of the United States. I do not add the president because there is now a president of Congress, so at the time they had a president of Congress in the Articles of Confederation, whose expenses may not be far, if anything short of those which will be incurred on account of the president of the United States. The support of the judges will clearly be an extra expense, but to what extent will depend on the particular plan which may be adopted in regard to this matter. But upon no reasonable plan can it amount to a sum which will be an object of material consequence, end quote. So he thought it was very important. He was willing to sacrifice the amount of pay that you would have to put into this plan as long as there was justice for the people and there was a very adequate judicial body there, which is extremely important. And he makes a very good point. I think that was something that was not objected to. How are you going to object to an idea of having judges and having a judiciary system? It's probably the most important system to have in a free government. So he states next, and I quote, "Let us now see what there is to counterbalance any extra expense that may attend the establishment of the proposed government. The first thing which presents itself is that a great part of the business which now keeps Congress sitting through the year will be transacted by the president. Even the management of foreign negotiations will naturally devolve upon him, according to the general principles concerted with the Senate and subject to their final concurrence. Hence, it is evident that a portion of the year will suffice for the session of both the Senate and the House of Representatives. We may suppose about a fourth for the latter and a third or perhaps half for the former. The extra business of treaties and appointments may give this extra occupation to the Senate. From this circumstance, we may infer that until the House of Representatives shall be increased greatly beyond its present number, there will be a considerable saving of expense from the difference between the constant session of the present and temporary session of the future Congress," end quote. So what he's saying is you're going to have a bunch of expenses that are not going to be charged because the Senate and the House of Reps, now that under the current system, the Congress was always in session. So you had to pay these people constantly. Now, the way the system's going to work is you give a little bit of those powers and the legislative authority to the president, where the president can make their own unilateral decisions because of this. And the legislature isn't going to have to meet as often as they were before. So that will, you know, get rid of some of these incurred losses or these incurred expenses. So next he states, and I quote, "The business of the United States has hitherto occupied the state legislatures as well as Congress. The latter has made requisitions which the former have had to provide for. Hence, it has happened that the sessions of the state legislatures have been protracted greatly beyond what was necessary for the execution of the mere local businesses of the states. More than half their time has been frequently employed in matters which related to the United States. Now the members who compose the legislatures of the several states amount to 2,000 and upwards, which number has hitherto performed what under the new system will be done in the first instance by 65 persons, and probably at no future period by above a fourth or fifth of that number. The Congress under the proposed government will do all the business of the United States themselves, without the intervention of the state legislatures, who thenceforth will have only to attend to the affairs of the particular states, and will not have to sit in any proportion as long as they have heretofore done. This difference in the time of the sessions of the state legislatures will be clear gain and will alone from an article of saving, which may be regarded as an equivalent for any additional objects of expense that may be occasioned by the adoption of the system, end quote. So yeah, it's a long quote. He's saying the state legislative bodies right now are dealing with a lot of these powers that are going to be given to the Congress. So they had to deal with a lot of federal stuff or national stuff where they were only responsible for their state legislators. They were only responsible for the state governments. And because of this, this will free up more time because we're going to have a federal legislature to handle these problems. And it will no longer be the problems of the state authorities, the state legislatures. This will free up more time. This is going to be better for the state governments. This is going to be better for the citizens of these states because their legislators will actually be concerned with things that are important to the state. So next, he goes on, he states, and I quote, "The result from these observations is that the sources of additional expense from the establishment of the proposed Constitution are much fewer than may have been imagined, that they are counterbalanced by considerable objects of saving, and that while it is questionable on which side the scale will preponderate, it is certain that a government less expensive would be incompetent to the purposes of the Union." End quote. So once again, if you want a government that's a little less expensive, it will be incompetent to the purposes of the Union, in terms of the national defense, in terms of the justice system, whether laws are to be made and protected or whether they're unjust laws, negotiations with foreigners, with foreign nations, foreign countries. That's another problem as well that should be given to the Union, right? So Hamilton, he ends this paper with a short defense of the taxation of the press as admissible and cites the example of taxation of the press in Great Britain characterized, and I'm quoting, "The press nowhere enjoys greater liberty than in that country," end quote. So yeah, once again, this was kind of like a weird thing. I think the Stamp Act, they had it during when Great Britain was in power. Hamilton specifically was talking about a very, very minute amount of taxation on the press and said, well, they do the same thing to the British, and they have some of the greatest liberty in terms of the press in the entire world. Which, whatever. I mean, I don't think I'm not a huge fan of taxing the press extra money, but I think the press right now is okay. I don't think they have any problems with taxation. So the taxation of the press is to be dependent on legislative discretion and with respect to the freedom of the press, in turn giving it greater security to defend against infringements of taxation. So yeah, I don't know exactly how taxation works on the press. But that will actually conclude this one. I know it's a long one. This was a very long paper. This might have been the second longest paper next to the last one that I just read off. So that'll be 84. We just wrapped that one up. And I think it says 85 is titled Concluding Remarks. That one's not extremely long. I mean, it's a pretty long one as well. But it's just going to be some concluding remarks. And then we're going to wrap this whole thing up. We're going to be done. And that'll be it for these. We'll continue to do the current event podcast as always. And, you know, in the meantime, I'm going to free up some extra time myself. I'm going to go through some courses and stuff, trying to change my my profession, what I do for a living. And then I'm going to try to, you know, I'm going to continue, though, to provide this free content for everybody. But because I do think I do have a decent base that I've created really through absolutely no marketing. I haven't paid any money into advertising. So I believe that I can keep coming here every single day and continue to give my best or twice a week and give my content. It's a show that you could tune into to get some news, get some facts from a conservative perspective, somebody that's kind of anti-establishment. I'm not super far right. I'm not like an anarchist. I would consider myself, I guess, like a conservative libertarian. I don't exactly know. I think there is some sort of role for government. I just think our government's way too big. But yeah, so I'll continue to just give that content away. I think it's very important. It's imperative to do so. And just, you know, just do me a favor, and I humbly request, just pass it on. Pass the mic. Let people know about the podcast. That's really it. Like, share, subscribe, you know. So I will see you folks next time. Everybody have a good one, and we're going to close it out with the concluding remarks in the next one, Federalist number 85, and then that will wrap up the entire series. So I greatly appreciate you folks tuning in for this entire thing. And I will see you all next time. Thank you.